This is a tribute. A tribute to Brace Beamer, better known to all of us as the Lone Ranger. He entertained millions of us as we grew up. He was, to an entire generation of people who were weaned on radio drama, the voice of honesty, justice, and law and order in the Old West. 30 minutes from now, you will hear one of the original Lone Ranger programs. One you haven't heard for probably 20 years or so, complete with the Masked Man, his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the evildoers brought to justice plot, and all the rest of it. As you know, all of us were shocked and saddened when Brace Beamer died suddenly earlier this week at the age of 62. He will be very much missed. And his booming voice uttering the familiar cry of
"I'll silver!"
I owe silver away will always strike a nostalgic twinge for all of us. Mr. Beamer was born in Mount Carmel, Illinois on December 9th, 1903. At the age of 14, he enlisted in the Army to become the youngest soldier in the American Expeditionary Forces in World War I. He then served 111 consecutive days in the trenches in France. He began his radio career as an announcer and an actor in Indianapolis in 1922, about the same time radio had its birth, by the way. He came to Detroit with WXYZ in 1932, and the following year, the Lone Ranger made its debut on the air. In a recent interview with Mr. Beamer, I asked him how long he had been with the Ranger.
Well, I made the first appearance on a horse in 1933, the same year it started, and the pictures were all of me and the entire show.
He was, however, not the only Lone Ranger.
You see, we had three Lone Rangers.
Who were they, in order?
I think the first one's name was Deeds, if I'm not mistaken. Now, I could be, but I'm pretty sure I'm not.
He was the Lone Ranger for a relatively short
time. Very short time. Right. Then George Seton, as you know.
Right.
Then Earl Grouser, who was killed. And I think, I'm not sure the year I went back in 1938, I think. I played the last 17 years.
The second most important character on the Lone Ranger was Tonto. Tonto, his faithful Indian companion, played by John Todd. Were they close personal friends in real life?
Not very, no.
You weren't?
No, we were friends, but we weren't friends socially. John had his group. John was a little older than I was.
Uh-huh.
You see, John was in his 80s when he died.
That's right.
And he had his classes, and he had his drama classes, which I wasn't at all interested in.
So that great camaraderie, that classic friendship was strictly confined to the show, right?
Oh, that's correct.
Tonto and the Masked Man.
I eat kimosabi.
Listen, Brace,
yes.
Tell us, what does kimosabi really mean?
Tai means hail in Potawatomi. Kimosabi means faithful friend, so put them together. Tai, kimosabi, hail, faithful friend.
Beamer was a man of great good humor and loved to tell these stories about the man who played Tonto.
John Todd loved to double parts, and he had several voices.
Yeah.
And he liked to double an Englishman's part. So one time, he's doubling this Englishman in the same show, and he's riding on the stagecoach. And a jackrabbit's supposed to run out alongside the stagecoach. John is supposed to say, "I think I'll chance a shot, you know." And he's making the motion with his hand to give the appearance like I'm doing now, riding, you
yeah.
see.
Uh-huh.
And he's supposed to shoot. His next line is, "Ah, a hit." Instead of that, when the director threw him the cue, after the shot, he said, "Ah, a cue." There was another funny one. Tonto and I were up in a hotel room searching these outlaws' luggage and baggage and so forth and so on. And at the end, I'm supposed to say, "All right, Tonto, there's nothing here. Let's get back to camp."
Uh-huh.
And John says, "Ah, kimosabi. Get him up, scout." We're in the second floor hotel room.
Another voice familiar to the millions of Lone Ranger fans was the voice of the narrator, Fred Foy. You'll recall his stirring introduction. It went like this.
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty hi-yo silver, the Lone Ranger.
Fred Foy is now with ABC in New York, and we contacted him by phone yesterday and asked him about Brace Beamer.
Well, I can say, number one, he was a good friend and, to me, a wonderful person because he carried over the character of the Lone Ranger into his personal life. In fact, to me, he was the Lone Ranger, whether on the microphone or off. And he brought this character to life to a great deal of youngsters, both on the air and off the air. I know it was one of his prime purposes to visit children's hospitals where many youngsters, of course, idolized the Lone Ranger, this was to them a real-life hero. And there were many instances where, in just going in his full regalia as the Lone Ranger, the mask and so on, that this would give these youngsters quite a tremendous lift. He was just, to me, a very good friend and a wonderful person, and it was quite a shock to learn that of his sudden passing.
The second part of Grace Beamer's career, as we all know, developed just a few weeks ago. A series of commercials were produced with his voice and some nostalgic moments from the Lone Ranger program itself. Well, the man whose idea it was is here with us tonight, Don Dolan of Young & Rubicam Advertising Agency here in Detroit. Don, when did the idea happen and how did it come about?
Well, about 3 or 4 months ago, which is, I think, was about 2 months before we started to put the stuff on the air, we did a demo tape with Grace for another product. Uh-huh. And because of his style of delivery and so forth, it never developed. But then we were asked by our local clients, they wanted to do something that sort of pinned down the fact that Chrysler was started here, was still built here, and so forth. So one thing led to another. We said, my goodness, Grace is living out in Oxford, and the star of a show that originated here and made good nationally. And so we just naturally tied the thing. It was Detroit's hometown car and Detroit's hometown radio show. But can I say one thing?
Sure.
Which I'd like to. The day that we called up Grace and asked him to do this, there's only one thing he said to me, and he said, sure, I'll do it if it's in good taste. And this to me sums up the whole man.
The thing that amazes me, the Lone Ranger went off the air the last time in 1955, and I can't ever recall hearing Brace Beamer's voice since then until this period. So was it, who discovered, that Brace Beamer was in Oxford, Michigan, and how did the name pop up again? Was it your idea? Did you dream it up one night? Or?
No, the basic idea was my idea, but Brace, we were all aware of Brace being around. But we felt that, I don't know, for some reason we figured that, he just wouldn't want to do something.
Well, he had been in retirement.
Yeah, sure. And if we figured he wanted to stay with his horses and not be bothered, coming in and out of town making commercials. But I think, and at least Brace indicated that he was having a heck of a time when he was doing these, because he was really enjoying it.
Yeah,
and,
we could tell that when we talked to him.
So it was a great privilege on my part to work with him, because like you and like everybody else over 30, I think that this man is an inseparable part of your childhood.
There were naturally hundreds of people connected with the Lone Ranger in one way or another during its first 22 years on the air. And we have some of them with us tonight to reminisce about Brace Beamer and the program. And many of the voices you will recognize immediately. We have the actors with us, Paul Hughes, Raleigh Parker, Jay Michael, Ernie Winstanley, one of the early directors on the program, Chuck Livingston, Fred Flowerday, one of the latter-day directors and a man who's been with the show for a long time. Chuck, I think, in terms of longevity with the show, is the oldest among us right now. Not in terms of age, Chuck.
Oh, that's true, too.
When did the Ranger start? Were you there?
I wasn't there at the beginning. It started in January of 1933, and I joined the company or the cast around August of 1933.
So he was just a few months old.
Yes, Brace at that time was chief announcer and studio manager of WXYZ.
What were you doing when you joined the cast?
I was an actor, and because of my voice, I was the heavy on most of the early Lone Ranger programs.
You played a lot of heavies in your day, didn't you?
In fact, from, I would say, 1933 to 1938, when I was fortunate enough to become the dramatic director of the Lone Ranger, I believe I played more heavies than any other man in the United States.
Whose idea was the Lone Ranger? Now, you were there just a few months after it began.
Well, I believe the story, which I believe, is that George W. Trindle wanted to create a character, a Robin Hood character with a Western background.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was the basis for starting, and I believe then that Jim Jewell, who was then director of the Lone Ranger...
Was he the first director?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
And he searched around and came up with this writer from Buffalo by the name of Fran Stryker. Mm-hmm. And Fran had been writing a play with a Western character, not based exactly the way Mr. Trindle wanted it, but from that they got together and The Lone Ranger was conceived.
And when it started, was it on a regular 3 times a week basis, or how was it run?
Yes, sir. It was a 7:30 in the evening play, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I think it always remained that way. And, it developed the it was the originator of the Mutual broadcasting system.
That's right. I understand that they developed Mutual only because to accommodate the Lone Ranger.
That's right. They wanted it. Gordon Baking Company had purchased the show, and they wanted it in the Chicago market, the Cincinnati market, the New York market, and the Detroit market.
What was Brace Beamer's affiliation with it in 1933?
In 1933, Brace was the narrator, a very important part of the Lone Ranger show.
Fred Flowerday, who now takes care of all the Lone Ranger tapes and guards them with his life, has them locked up in a vault, mm-hmm. has been with the show for a long time, too. When did you start, Fred?
I started in late 1934.
What were you doing?
I was hired by George W. Trendle, and he sent me down to see Brace. That was the first time I saw Brace, and Brace was then station manager. And so Brace sent me up to see Jim Jewell, who was then director, and I started in doing sound effects, opening and closing doors, and working with Ted Robertson, who was then the chief sound technician, and...
I understand. By the way, I think I should point out that at that time, Fred was nothing but an acne-faced young teenage boy.
Right.
Tell us about some of the sound effects. Now, in those days, there weren't any recorded sound effects, were there?
No, most of our sound effects were done manually. I mean, we had a large sound effects staff. I think there were four at the time when I started, and our gunshots were done manually. We had no recorded gunshots.
Well, how would you do a manual gunshot?
Well, strangely enough, the first gunshot was a rat trap that was fastened to a large thunder drum.
Uh-huh.
And on cue, when a gunshot was called for, why, one of us would spring this rat trap and it would go on the thunder drum and give the effect of a gunshot.
Well, you couldn't do any rapid firing, could you?
just as fast as you could work this rat trap, I presume. But then we went to an improvement over that. We had large cardboard boxes that we would use and hit these boxes with a stick. The famous series of gunshots, the six at the opening, were done by a sound technician as he hit this large cardboard carton.
Tell us about some of the other early sound effects, the horse's hooves.
Well, the hoofbeats progressed in the same way the gunshots did. They were done manually, of course, and they always have been. But we did the rhythm of the horses galloping on our knees with our hands. And then it progressed.
How would you do that? You would just slap your thigh?
We'd slap our thighs. That's a bad gait right there. Yeah. I'm not used to doing
that. Chuck will take it to Belle Isle and have a little
yeah, and we did that too, didn't we, Roy?
Yes, we did.
And then we took, hit our chest with our hands in the rhythm of the...
That was on very soft turf.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then from that, we went to the sink plungers, the short-handled sink plungers that we clop together in rhythm, one against the other. And then as we were continually trying to get better sounds, and I think we prided ourselves in our sound department, our sound effects, we tried hard, and I think we got some good ones. But we went to a gravel box that was filled with gravel, a foot and a half deep, and we would vertically plunge the sink plungers into the gravel to give us a sound.
It sounded like a horse galloping down a trail. And sound effects were so much a part of radio drama. As we all know, it's all imagery. It's what the mind envisions. And I can't imagine anybody listening to a Lone Ranger program ever think of when they heard the horses galloping of a couple of plungers in a box of gravel.
Well, we changed the terrain, too. If we had the Ranger and Tonto going in sandy soil, there'd be one box, a part of the box reserved for that particular material. If they were going through underbrush, we would put broom corn because the sound of the horses going through. We even went so far as the director called for the sound of the bridle as we would...
How would you do that? With a leather chain and a bell? Or a piece of leather and a bell?
We actually had some bits of bridle that we would hold in our hands. So when the horse is galloping, we'd have the jingle in time with the gait of the horse.
Tell
when the
horse would jump a chasm one mountainside to the other, about 40 feet.
How would you do that?
just stopped galloping, J.P.
Dead pause.
Then Fred, when the horses went over the bridge.
We would switch from the gravel box. Two other sound men would be down on a wood floor, and we'd invert the sink plungers and do the hard wood handles on the wood floor to give the sound of the horses.
Fred, who would give the cues for all this? Now, you had one director, and Chuck was the director at the time. You were doing most of these manual effects. Would you have to cue the actors and the sound effects people all at the same time?
Yes, sir.
That took a lot of synchronization.
It did.
To keep your fingers crossed.
Well, this group and these boys, they were... show after show after show, and they became used to this method. It was different than most dramatic shows in that we had a separate studio for sound effects so that we could set a level that wouldn't drown out the voice when the actors were in a different studio.
Mm-hmm.
And this way we kept the balance between the voice and the sound so that it was easy to understand. We also had a problem, remember, with the music, Fred? When the Ranger first went on the air, there were complaints that the music was too loud. The engineers were carrying this at a zero level,
And on their, what do they call that?
Volume control.
And the music, even, it wasn't slopping over the zero, but it was too loud, and we'd get letters of complaint, and Mr. Trendle would get at us, and finally, we decided the thing to do was to hold the music at a minus four and peak the voices at zero, and from that time on, people did not have to touch their radio sets when the music came on and pull it down.
Chuck, speaking of the music, the William Tell Overture, for as long as any of us live, will be... Not the William Tell Overture, but the Lone Ranger theme. Was it always the Lone Ranger theme? Was
yes,
it the first one?
They tried, one time they did try the Light Cavalry Overture, but this didn't carry the feeling that they wanted. It was the only one that was used on the air.
One of the most celebrated and publicized change of voices, you'll recall, was when Bobby Breen's voice changed. Another one, equally important and equally traumatic, I'm sure, to the guy involved, was the man who played the Lone Ranger's nephew, Dan Reed. Ernie Winstanley. Yeah. When did you start as Dan Reed?
Well, in early 34, right after Chuck. As a matter of fact, Chuck used to pick me up out of Orchard Lake and bring me in corduroy knickers. And I played that for about 3 years, as I recall. 2 or 3 years, and my voice changed, and then I graduated into the sound department under Fred. I had been doing a little bit of sound.
Well, how did they write you out of the script, Ernie?
There were about, all told, as I recall, 5 or 6 different Dan Reeds.
I see.
And he was not in every show, of course. He was in maybe 1 out of 12.
Uh-huh, right, Chuck? That's right.
Something...
It had to be a heartbreaking experience for you when you find your voice getting lower and lower.
Well, I think he kind of liked it because then he got to play these young, manly juveniles, these handsome heroes.
Well, Ernie, you actually grew up with the Lone Ranger.
Oh, yes.
And
right.
Tell us about the different parts you played. Proceed from where you were Dan Reed after your voice changed.
Then I played mostly as Chuck says, the dashing young juvenile right through until...
Always a good guy?
Pretty much in those days, yeah.
Blue shirt
until,
me.
Cavalry
lieutenant.
Until 1941, when I went into service, and then when I came back, Chuck started me playing just all different types of characters, as we all did. You never knew what you were going to play until you appeared at rehearsal. You had no idea what character
well,
you
were. Well, we all did ad lib.
That voice, ladies and gentlemen, belongs to Jay Michael. Jay has one of the most easily recognized voices, I think. You all will recognize it when you hear him speak. How long were you with the Ranger?
Well, I hate to say it, but I arrived on the scene about 29 years ago.
Yeah. And how many different parts do you figure you played?
Just about everything. I think I played more villains than anything else, though. But
you were classified sheriff. As a heavy.
A heavy, yes, right. Because a heavy voice, you can't do much with it, lighten it up.
Well, I know you played some old timers.
Sure, I played old timers. Sure.
But in later years, Chuck was Black Bart originally, and then Jay
was
became
Black Bart.
Oh, were you
Black?
Were you the Lone Ranger's arch rival, Black Bart?
Oh yeah.
Give us the Black Bart voice. You recall it?
I'm telling you, masked man, I got you covered with this gun. One move and you're out of the picture. You understand?
Wonderful.
Oh, he shot my gun out of my hand.
You know, now, that brings up another point. All of you who are actors on the show had to go through these tremendous sounds indicating to the audience listening that you were doing something physical. You were getting shot or you were in a fight. Would you do this just naturally as you were doing the script? Was it indicated in the script? In other words, if you were socked, Black Bart.
Oh, no, they didn't put sock in the script, no.
All right.
Well, no, there's a man standing in front of you with a pad and a fist, and he'd go like that. You'd take an immediate reaction, and you'd back up a little bit as if you fell back.
Yeah.
Then come in again, and a lot of times the fights would be going back and forth when you had a fist fight.
When you
approached, you always, woo, yeah. And you'd dismount.
Would you also get breathless, right, if you'd
been
in a fight scene?
Yes.
You'd just do this automatically.
We even had footsteps when you entered a bar on the floor.
Yeah.
Man walking across. Sometimes they said, well, you couldn't hear a man walking across a bar. It's noisy, but we had them.
Well, he had spurs on and things like that they had sound for.
Well, due to this physical work they did, we always played an arm's distance from the microphone. We never crawled up close to the microphone because you couldn't react physically if you were that close to the phone.
Yeah.
The microphone.
Another one of the most easily recognized voices in the country is the voice that belongs to Paul Hughes. Paul, when did you join the Ranger?
Oh, I'm just one of the newer members. I didn't come in until about 1939.
Yeah. I always recall you as the sheriff.
Yes, well, you never knew from day to day what you were going to do.
Yeah, but most of the time you were a good guy, weren't you? Weren't you on the side of law and order most of the time?
I'd say about 50% of the time. I'd kill one day, and And Doctor the next.
Yeah. I think one of the characters that Paul developed was very familiar to everybody was the Thunder Martin.
Thunder Martin, yeah.
Tell us about Thunder Martin. Who is he now? I don't recall it.
Give me a little bit of that, Paul.
Well, Thunder Martin was the...
Wally Berry.
Wally Berry character.
Yeah. Was he a good guy or a bad guy?
He was a good guy.
Yeah.
Always getting into trouble. I think it impressed me particularly about this show, just to get off another tack. When I first came up here, I came from what they might call a soap opera station down in Cincinnati. And it was a speed. I remember my first script, I had a well in the butt on the second page.
You had to do what now?
Huh? I had just two broken speeches. One was a well and one was a butt. I remember turning away from the microphone to the top of the page to clear my throat. When I came back, they were way at the bottom of the page. I never did get my well and butt.
We never waited.
Raleigh Parker is another familiar voice to all. Raleigh, I think you were on almost every Lone Ranger episode I ever heard.
Not quite that many.
How many do you figure that you did?
Oh, it's hard to say. Over a period of 19 years, maybe twice a week. What would that be? Quite a few.
Oh, 15, 16, 1700, Bill.
Yeah, a lot of them. Now, you were generally... Well, of course, you were split up, too. But I seem to remember you as a good guy most of the time. We're trying to separate the good guys from the bad guys tonight.
Well, as we say when some novice asks you, what did you do on the Lone Ranger? The only answer you can give is... Good guy, bad guy, Chinese cook, Mexican, old man, young man, banker, lawyer. Chuck had us rotated so that each time we came down to rehearsal, old boy, just a short part, but it's an old man.
Yeah.
Next time, a long part of a villain, sometimes.
You did a lot of dialects, really.
And didn't you also, didn't you all do many different parts in any given Lone Ranger episode?
Oh, yes.
Frequently.
Well, I wish Raleigh would tell the story. Raleigh doubled Tonto quite a lot when John Tom was on vacation.
Unfortunately.
I
think he's got a
that.
Very funny story about the woman that called after a broadcast.
Oh, during one of John Todd, who was a fine Tonto, during one vacation period somehow or other, Mr. Livingston Chuck put me in a Tonto for a couple of weeks. And after one show, I was lousy. After one show, there was a phone call Chuck told me about. He tried to coach me and help me. I can't use the word, but the lady said, That's an Indian?
Is that the only time you played Tonto for those 2 weeks?
4 weeks altogether. Then that was it.
Did you just soon forget that period?
Sure would, yeah.
How would you do several different parts in one show? Would you ever have one speech as one character, for example, and then, you know, run into yourself? In other words, have a conversation with yourself?
No, they're written sometimes that way, but the director, Chuck Livingston, would fix it so that you'd have plenty of time to go from, well, howdy, ma'am, to something like, that's enough out of you now. You couldn't do it immediately, but he'd have some other speeches in between.
You know, now, most of those Lone Ranger episodes were done live. There was no tape in those days. You know, it had to be perfect. There was no fluffing allowed, and there were very few.
No fluffing allowed.
There must have been some interesting, maybe amusing experiences that you guys remember. Tell me about them.
I can tell you one. You might have forgotten, you fellas. John Hodiak, who's not with us now, he had a line as a big hero as he backed up to the mic to say, I'm off to the execution. And at the time, he was taking voice lessons. And he said, I'm off to the elocution. Remember that?
Now, it would seem to me that would send a nervous cast into gales of laughter.
It would.
You guys didn't even react.
Sometimes, but when you look in Chuck's face in the control room, you soon regained your poise.
was he a little blue in the face?
A little bit, or you disappeared down below the counter.
How about some of the other, you know,
let me tell one of my mayors that Grace told on an interview last year of Frank Russell, dear soul, played character parts with us, was playing a sheriff one night. And he and the posse had located the gang of crooks, and it was at night, and they had their little camp in a circle surrounded by a forest. Well, Frank deployed his men all around a certain signal. They were all to come in, and he would say, all right, gents, get your guns up. So the time came, and he stepped on the clerk. He says, all right, gents, get your guns up. All right, gents, get your guns up. I'll shoot them.
And you always recovered. Now, did the script... It was always timed, of course, to run just a half hour, wasn't it, Chuck? Exactly?
That's right, yes, sir. We were fortunate. I don't believe we ever ran over one strip. This is network.
Was there ever time when you had to cut some lines?
Oh, yes. Sometimes we had to cut quite a bit.
Well, how would you do this? How would the, when would you were doing this live, and I assume that you decided to cut the lines right then and there.
Oh, no. This was done...
Chuck, I think it'd be interesting to give a sort of a production schedule as how we did the show. These actors came in with a cold script, Joe. They never had seen it before the rehearsal was called. Why don't you just give a...
We had 3 hours to do the show.
Right. What time would the actors get there?
Well, let's say, was it 3:30 that we started?
I think 3:30.
We'd take a reading, which took approximately 1 hour, and then the timing would take 1 half hour, because we would have our script cut down to just about the size that we needed.
Uh-huh.
Then we would have a break.
Casino break.
Everybody can relax.
And then the production rehearsal, that's where we put the sound effects and everything in it. This took 1 hour, and then a half hour for dress rehearsal.
And the dress rehearsal, presumably you'd have everything chopped down to time.
Everything was timed the way we used to time it, every 15 seconds, and the time at the end of the scene, and the time at the beginning of the next scene. And we also backed up from the closing time that we had to have, and we had a deadline that we had to meet, which meant we either had to speed them up at times or slow them down. We had a system of signals, which they all understood, and they were different probably from the normal radio station drama. It sort of mixed up actors who we pick up, who would come in, and they wouldn't understand that when you took your hand and brought it down, palm toward them, flat, that meant slow down, and when you turned your hand the other way and brought it up, that meant pick it up. Pick it up or slow it down. And when you wanted them to get back to their normal tempo, it was a horizontal move of the hand, which meant go back to normal.
How was Brace Beamer to work with as an actor and as a man, Chuck?
As a man...
You directed him for many years.
Brace was one of the finest individuals I've ever had the fortune enough to know and work with. He had a heart as big as he was. And he was a man's man, let's say, and he was opinionated. He definitely had his ideas on how certain things should be done. And naturally, in the stress of rehearsals, we used to come to differences of ideas, but Brace's ideas were entirely set on what the Lone Ranger would feel and do. He was the man physically, he was the man mentally, and he was the Lone Ranger in his heart.
He really was, wasn't
yes.
he? Mm-hmm. When he went, I talked to Brace Beamer just a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him the same thing. Where did Brace Beamer stop and the Lone Ranger start and vice versa? And he told me that, no, as soon as he went home, he was no longer the Lone Ranger. But everybody I talked to, all of you people who work with him, say that was not so, that he was the Lone Ranger always.
He was. His feelings toward people, his interest in people, and the things that he did for people followed right straight through with the Lone Ranger's character.
He was a great humanitarian. I don't think any of us, Joe, can not recall at one time or another that he hadn't done something for us.
He believed it. Sorry, Joe.
No, go ahead.
He believed in the ideals of the Lone Ranger. He carried them through in his life outside the studio.
Chuck, you were telling me before we started here, reminiscing about an instance you recall that probably vividly and dramatically demonstrates what we're trying to say about Brace Beamer.
Well, this happened at the time we had a contest, and there was one city in the United States was picked to change its name to Lone Ranger Frontier Town for one day. And this happened to be Cheyenne, Wyoming. And Brace had to be out there to make a personal appearance. And we all went out on a train, and in Chicago we changed trains, and the news had gotten along in Illinois, I think, that we went through, and Brace got out at the platform between two of the cars and looked out the window, and as he came along in these little cities, little towns, there were, I would say, groups of from 40 to 200 children, school children, that had heard about this, and as he came by, they'd all wave at him, and he waved his hand at them, and I stood there watching him, And golly, the tears were just streaming down his face. It was something which I shall never forget, and definitely demonstrates the feeling that this man had. And Brace never felt that it was honoring Brace Beamer. Well, it was in a way, but this was a salute to this person, this character, which he had created and had played so well and so long.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful story. Paul, do you have any particular memory that you'd like to talk about tonight, an amusing incident or anything in your many years with the Ranger?
Oh, many of them. I can't tie it down to any particular one either.
How about the pay, Paul? Was the pay pretty good in those days?
Sure was.
Was it? I think this might be interesting to people. What now? See, it's 1938, and you're all gainfully employed actors on the Lone Ranger.
In those days, that wasn't bad, but golly, when I started, it was $2.50 a show.
$2.50 a show. That was in 1933.
Yes, sir.
We got $10 for the Ranger, and that was with two repeats. We did the show three times a night.
Yeah, once for here, the East Coast, once for Central, and then for the West Coast.
$5 a show and two and a half.
I'm glad to get it, Joe. I think there were five or six actors under contract. Johnny Hodiak was one, Jay was another.
Al Hodge, Grace Beamer.
For $45 a week.
You were the high paid fellas.
That was for doing, I think, anything. About 12 shows.
Because well, we did everything. We did three Rangers a week in those days.
Yeah. Actually, nine.
I'll never forget the day I was under contract of 40, and so was John Hodiak, and we went downtown. Our contracts were being renewed. John said, you go up first, so I went upstairs and talked to Mr. Campbell, who was then vice president. And he started pulling out the files and showing me letters. He had them all over the country, people who worked cheaper than we were getting. I cried a little bit. And finally, I said, I might as well sell insurance. And I started to walk out. He said, I'll give you $45. I just sold. John Hodiak went up, and they wouldn't give him a cent more. And he went to Chicago, and there became a movie star.
What were you thinking when you walked out?
I won't say nothing.
Well, I can tell you that Fred and I got 12 and a half a week.
Sound effects man. Mm-hmm. $12.50.
Was that your start, friend?
I think it was just about that, yeah.
Of course, you fellas didn't use your voices then.
No. Yeah, I doubled many times.
You were just wearing out your hands with the plungers in the box of gravel. Yeah. For years now, ever since the Lone Ranger went off the air in 1955, Fred Flowerday and Ernie Winstanley have had every day to pass by a file drawer full of these magnificent old tapes. And I'm certain that on every day that you guys walked by them, you must have thought, when can we get it back on the air? What are the prospects now? Is there any chance? I know that it's running in several stations around the country.
Yes, and I hope it's going to run a lot more. There have been a total of about 32 stations who have contracted to rerun these Lone Ranger shows, which are all on tape. The quality is good, and the interest has been excellent from stations in New Jersey and Phoenix and in the South, New York State.
Mm-hmm.
And every day we have inquiries from other stations wanting to know if it's available for their market. And I sincerely hope that the Lone Ranger will still ride for a good many years.
Yeah, he certainly will with all of us anyway, Fred. You know, I remember more about the ending of the Lone Ranger shows than I do now in retrospect about everything else. And as I mentioned before, I always recall the ending of the show would always end the same way. The evildoers, of course, had been brought to justice. And generally, the bad guy was getting arrested by the sheriff. And there was another guy there, too. And the bad guy would look at either the sheriff or the other fella. And he would, you know, be startled and very put out because he had been taken in by this masked man. And he would always say, you know, who is the masked man? Could we recreate that now with Paul and Paul Hughes? And J. Michael and Raleigh Parker. Raleigh, you be the bad guy, okay, who's getting arrested by the sheriff, and you're put out. Paul, you be the sheriff. And Jay, you be the bystander, the town mayor. All right? Okay, now, Raleigh.
Who was that masked man?
He's the masked man. I don't know. Who was he?
Why, that was the Lone Ranger.
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver! The Lone Ranger! With his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains, led the fight for law and order in the early Western United States. Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again.
Come on, Silver. Let go, big fella. Hail, Silver. Hooray!
¶¶
The town of Gunsmoke, located near the eastern edge of the Arizona desert, was shrouded in darkness as Jack Barton, the 20-year-old son of the banker, moved softly out the back door of his father's home. He closed the door gently, then made his way to the stable behind the house. In the stable, he loaded supplies into a saddlebag, then proceeded to saddle his own black horse. And while he worked, he spoke in a low voice.
Running away, Blackie. That's what I'm doing. But I have no choice. I've got to go away. Stay away. Quiet, Blackie, quiet. Dad's gonna be mighty broken up, but not nearly as broken up as he'd be if I stayed here to hang for murder. Easy now. Get up. Get up there, Blackie.
The son of the banker rode all night, heading west across the arid desert. At daybreak, he halted the black horse and dismounted.
Ho, Blackie, ho, ho, easy. Gosh, Blackie, just about starved. We've covered a lot of ground since midnight. We've earned a little rest.
Jack moved a few paces away from the horse. Then suddenly...
Blackie, come back here! Blackie! Ho, Blackie! Ho, boy!
But the horse kept going, running at a fast gait toward the town which Jack had left.
Gone. I guess I'll have to travel on foot.
Hungry, thirsty, with neither food nor water within many miles, the son of the banker continued west, on foot. The mid-afternoon sun was blistering hot as the Lone Ranger and Tonto rode east across a vast expanse of Arizona desert toward the town of Gunsmoke. For the past few minutes, they had been watching vultures flying low. Presently, they saw a motionless form lying on the sun-baked ground.
Come on, Silver!
Let's scout!
A moment later, they dismounted at the side of a well-dressed man who seemed to be about 20 years old.
Bring your canteen, Toto.
Me get it.
And the fellow's alive.
Me see him move. Aye, so.
Water.
Here, water.
I'll hold your head up. Now, take only a couple of swallows and wait before you drink any more.
Oh, thanks.
Are you injured?
No. You're masked.
Are you going to reject our help because of that?
No. No more water, please.
Of course. Now, drink slowly.
It's good. If you hadn't come, I'd have died here.
What's your name?
Barton. Jack Barton. I suppose there's no use asking your name. If you wanted to be known, you wouldn't be masked.
I have personal reason for wearing a mask, but I'm not an outlaw. Oh, where's your horse?
I don't know. Probably back in Gunsmoke by this time.
Is your home in Gunsmoke?
Yes, I left there last night.
Oh?
This morning I stopped to prepare some food. As soon as I dismounted, my horse bolted. Ran off with my canteen, saddlebags, everything I had.
Have you been traveling on foot since then?
Yes, until I collapsed.
You need food as well as water.
Me get food from saddlebags.
Good. Jack, we're going east. After you've eaten, we'll take you to Gunsmoke. My horse can carry double.
No, no, I can't go back.
Are you dodging the law?
No, it's nothing like that. I just can't go back, that's all. I must keep going west.
You can't travel on foot.
I'll have to.
Even though you could keep walking, it would take 3 days to reach water. It's certain death to travel on foot in this country.
It doesn't matter.
It matters to Tonto and me. We can't leave a man to die on the desert.
You'll have to, because I'm not returning to Gunsmoke.
Oh, are you afraid to go back?
No, no. It's just that I don't want to hurt my dad.
How would he be hurt by your return?
It's a long story.
Oh, wait. I just remembered. I've heard of a man named Barton who owns a bank in Gunsmoke. Is he your father?
I call him Dad. My real father died when I was a baby. Mr. Barton adopted me. He's the finest man I know. I'd rather die than hurt him.
Tell me why you'd hurt him by going home.
I I don't see why you're interested.
Jack, I don't want to hurt anyone, least of all a fine man like Banker Barton. But we can't leave you to die in the desert. We're going to take you to Gunsmoke, by force if necessary.
No. If you knew what that would mean to Dad, you...
I'm trying to find out.
All right, I'll tell you.
Good.
Here, fold it.
Put it beside the canteen, Tonto. Help yourself, Jack, while you tell us your story.
Hey, thanks. There's a man in Gunsmoke named Regan. Harv Regan.
Owner of the gambling casino?
Oh, yes. Is he a friend of yours?
No. I'm sure Regan's a crook, but the law has never been able to prove it.
I know he's a crook, and I can't prove it.
What were you going to say about him?
Well, a short time ago, one of his employees came into the bank. I worked there for Dad.
Yes?
The man came to me and said Regan wanted to talk about investments.
Huh?
He couldn't come to the bank during office hours because he worked all night and slept most of the day. He wanted me to call on him at the casino in the evening.
Did you?
Yes. I knew Regan had a lot of money to invest. Knew his account was worth going after. When I reached the casino, a man told me Regan was busy in his office. He asked me to wait in a private room. It was a large room, and 8 or 9 men were playing roulette. I didn't know then that all those men worked for Harv Regan. I found that out later. I stood watching the game when a man called Lefty Martin pushed in close beside and started to play. He lost several times in a row.
16 red, the winner. I lost again.
That's too bad, Lefty.
This hombre bumped my arm and made me put my chips on the wrong number.
Oh, you mean me?
Yes, you.
Now, take it easy, Lefty. That's Banker Barton's son. He's waiting to see Harv Regan.
He's got no right to bump my arm.
I didn't touch your arm.
You calling me a liar?
Now, Lefty, take it easy.
No one can call me a liar. I'll teach this young upstart.
Oh, slap me, will you?
Oh, you hit me. You want to fight, huh?
Now, hold on, Lefty.
Let me go. I'll teach young Barton a lesson.
Let go of Lefty so he can defend himself.
I'll help you, Barton.
You keep out of it.
Let go of my arm.
Wait a minute.
No.
Who are you?
Wait a minute now.
Within a few seconds after Lefty slapped me and I struck back, it was a regular free-for-all. Regan's employees fought among themselves on all sides of me. And then I heard a gunshot. The fighting stopped. I saw Lefty Martin lying on the floor.
All right, out of my way.
And then I heard Harv Regan. He approached, saying...
What's going on here? What was that shot?
Mr. Regan, Barton and Lefty had a fight, and Lefty was shot.
Barton must have shot him.
Oh, I did not. I have no gun.
Must have used a sleeve gun, then tossed it...
Oh, no!
Fire!
Yeah, too.
Any of the customers in the main hall hear the row?
Well, I doubt it, boss. The walls and door are thick. Well,
I'll keep this quiet. See how bad Lefty's hurt and do whatever's necessary.
All right. Come on, give me a hand, Jack.
Barton, you come into my office.
Oh, Mr. Regan, Lefty started the fight. He slapped my face.
Here we are, Jack. Step inside. Sit down and relax.
I didn't shoot Lefty Martin. I've never used a gun in my life.
Too bad it happened, Jack. A man in your position can't afford to be mixed up in a gambling house brawl.
What'd I tell you?
Mr. Regan, Lefty Martin is dead.
What?
Dead, huh?
Yes, sir. We found this sleeve gun on the floor. It's been fired once.
Leave the gun with me.
Yeah. What do we do about Lefty?
Nothing until you hear from me. Wait in the other room.
Yes, sir.
This your gun, Jack?
No, I never owned a gun. And I didn't shoot...
Let me give you the straight facts. All the men in that private game are in my employ, and my men stick together. They'll all swear you used this gun and shot Lefty Martin.
They can't do that. They can't get away with
it. Yes, they can. Their evidence will hang you, and that would break your father's heart.
No.
I've always admired your father, Jack. For his sake, I don't want to see you face a murder trial.
I'll not have to. Unless those men in the next room lie about who shot Lefty Martin.
They stick together. They wouldn't let one of their pals hang. But they know someone has to hang for that shooting. So they'll frame you.
Yeah, but I didn't do it.
Well, as I see it, there's one way out for you.
Well, what is it?
We'll have to give the man who really did the shooting enough money to clear out of the country. The boys know he's well fixed in Mexico. I can persuade them to tell the truth.
How much money?
About $2,000 should do it.
$2,000? I haven't that much money.
You will have someday. You're the banker's heir.
Well, yes.
Jack,
but...
for your father's sake, I'll loan you the money. I'll take your IOU.
But it may be years before
I... Don't worry about it. I'll take care of everything.
Did you sign the IOU?
Yes. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. It seemed like the only way out of the trouble. But the next day, I learned that Lefty Martin wasn't dead. He wasn't even hurt. The whole performance was a scheme to get me to sign that IOU.
Why did Regan want you in debt to him?
Because he wanted me to help his gang rob the bank.
Oh.
He had it all planned. I was supposed to be working there at night. I sometimes worked at night, especially at the end of the month. But on a certain night, I was to be working with the safe open when Regan and his men came in.
I see.
They were to leave me bound in gags so it wouldn't appear that I'd helped in the robbery.
And if you had refused to help Regan?
He threatened to show Dad the IOU and say I'd lost the money gambling.
What would your father have done about that?
He'd have disowned me. You see, my real father gambled. He was killed in a fight over a card game, and he was Mr. Barton's best friend. So Mr. Barton hated gambling. I knew he'd disown me. And worse than that, he'd be terribly hurt and disappointed in me.
I understand.
That's why I ran away.
Jack, without that IOU, Regan will have no hold on you. We must get it away from him.
On the desert where the Lone Ranger and Tonto had saved his life, Jack Barton told of the circumstances which had forced him to leave his home. After hearing his story, a masked man decided that they should return to Gunsmoke and get the IOU Regan held.
Oh, that can't be done.
Do you know where he keeps it?
No, probably locked up in his office, maybe in the safe.
How late is the gambling casino open?
Till 3 a.m. But Regan stays there. He lives in the same building.
Yeah, we'll call on him.
He's never unguarded. 3 men live there with him. Lefty Martin and 2 others. And they're gunmen.
3 gunmen, huh? Well, 4 warned is 4 armed.
What are you going to do?
We'll start now and head toward Gunsmoke. Ready, Toto?
Be ready.
I'm sure we can reach the woods near town by 3 a.m. You're going with us, Jack.
Oh, but I can't...
If Regan can't get your aid in robbing the bank, he'll probably take the IOU to Barton and try to collect the money. So you'll not save your dad from grief by running away. Easy.
Steady, big fella.
Give me your hand. I'll help you mount behind my saddle.
All right. But I don't see what you can do.
I'm going to try to get that IOU away from Regan.
Yeah, but why? Why are you going to help me?
There are lots of men who'd welcome the chance to fight in behalf of a good citizen like Banker Barton. Come on, Silver!
Come on, Scout!
During the long ride, Jack Barton, responding to questions, told the Lone Ranger all he knew about the gambling casino and Regan's living quarters in the same building. It was shortly after 3 a.m. when the masked man and Tonto drew rein in the dark woods near the town of Gunsmoke.
Dismount, Jack.
I don't see how you expect to get that IOU from Regan. I've told you how well he's guarded.
Easy, said the big fella. We're going to try to draw the guards away from Regan, and I'll speak to him alone.
You got plan, Kemosabe?
Yes, Tonto. Jack, you said Regan spends about an hour in his office after the casino is closed for the night.
Well, that's right. He balances the cash and takes care of the books. It's a little after 3, so he's probably there right now.
That office is in the rear of the building?
Yes.
What we do, Kemosabe?
We ride to the edge of the woods behind the casino.
You want me to go with you?
No, Jack. I want you to wait right here until we return. Give me your word that you'll stay here. I'll leave you untied.
I'll give you my word. I'll stay until you return.
Good. We'll see you later.
What we do when we get behind the casino?
I'll tell you while we're on the way, Tonto. Easy,
easy, easy,
come
easy,
come on, Silver.
Come on, Scout.
A short time later, the Lone Ranger and Tonto drew rein and dismounted in a clump of trees. They saw the back windows of the gambling casino, less than 50 yards away.
The lighted window on the left is Regan's office.
Kemosabe, oh. You take plenty big risks.
It's justified.
Leaving their horses at ground hitch, the 2 men walked softly across the open area until they reached the lighted window.
Keep down, Tonto. I'll look through the window.
You see Regan?
Yes. He's seated at his desk, facing the other way. He's alone.
Jack, Sagard's always near.
I know. Here goes.
With a barrel of his gun, the Lone Ranger smashed the window.
What the...
Hold it, Regan. You're covered.
Mask!
Yes, I'm here on business.
Don't shoot. My hands are up.
If you don't want me to shoot, move carefully. Come over here and open this window.
Very well.
We've met before, Regan.
What?
I turned you over to the law in Texas when you were a stage robber.
You, the Lone Ranger?
Right. Now step back to your desk while I climb through the window.
Why are you here? What do you want? I did my stretch in jail. I'm clear with the law.
I came for an IOU signed by Jack Barton.
Oh. You're dead, huh?
Yes. Where is it?
I'm glad you came here. Very glad. I've often hoped the day would come when I could pay you for sending me to prison.
Where is the IOU?
You're not going to get it. In fact, you're not going to leave this room alive.
No?
Several men have come here with the intention of robbing me. And they've all fallen into the same trap.
I see no trap.
No? Well, right now you're covered by three guns held by men behind the walls. Look closely and you'll see the loopholes. There's one beneath that picture. There's another over there. Lefty, is he covered?
Yeah, boss. We're watching him.
You see? At a word from me, you'll be a dead man.
Regan, not knowing that the Lone Ranger had anticipated the trap, smiled confidently. Tonto, outside the window, took careful aim at the single lamp that lighted the room.
Have you anything to say before I tell my men to kill you?
Hank! Lefty!
At the instant Tonto fired, the Lone Ranger dashed across the office and opened a door.
Get him!
The shots from the concealed gunman were too late. The masked man ran through the private gambling room, then through a door to the area behind the building.
Come on, Tonto!
The two men were over halfway to the grove of trees by the time Regan's gunman reached the door and opened fire.
We have more of a start than I thought we'd have.
Them not hit us. Night, too dark.
Shoot again! Get that masked man!
In another moment, the Lone Ranger and Tonto reached their horses in the shelter of the trees.
You know the plan.
Me know.
Tonto leaped to his saddle, but the Lone Ranger remained unmounted. He handed Silver's reins to the Indian.
Here you are.
Me lead him.
Come on, Silver!
Get him up, scout!
Both horses raced away, but the masked man stayed behind. He crouched low, concealing himself in underbrush, and waited. Meanwhile, Regan's face livid with rage as he spoke to his gunman.
That was the Lone Ranger. I want him killed.
But he and his Indian pal had horses hidden among the trees, boss.
You heard him riding away.
Go to the stable next door and get horses. Go after them. That Lone Ranger knows about the Barton IOU. If I don't get him, he'll make trouble.
All right, boss.
Regan went with the gunman to the stable. While three horses were being saddled, he gave voice to his hatred of the masked man who had sent him to prison.
And I'll pay $1,000 if you bring him back dead.
Hey, say, that's worth going after.
Easy, boy. We're ready.
Let's go.
Come on, get up. Come on.
Regan watched his men ride out the back door of the stable and race toward the woods. Then he returned to the casino. In the main room, now empty, he helped himself to a drink. After lingering for several minutes, he went into his office. As he opened the door, he remembered that the lamp had been smashed by a bullet. He struck a match. And as he held it to the wick of an unbroken lamp, he observed with surprise that the wooden shutter had been closed on the broken window.
I thought that shutter was open.
Then, from a corner of the room, he heard a voice.
You're covered.
You?
Yes. I returned as soon as your man rode past me in the woods.
But...
Keep your hands up. Well, I see if you carry a sneak gun. Unarmed, huh?
Yes. Yes, I'm unarmed. You can't shoot a helpless man.
I have no intention of shooting you, Regan. But unless I get a certain IOU, I'm going to make you beg for a bullet to end your misery. Just to show you what I mean. That's just the beginning. Stand up. Come on, stand up.
Wait, listen.
We're alone now, Regan. No one to save you from this.
No.
Get off the floor.
No, don't slap me again.
Slapping's the least painful. But if you say so, I'll use my fists. Come on, get up!
I
let me go, please. I'll pay you.
I told you what I want.
All right, I'll give you that IOU.
Where is it?
In the safe. That safe right there.
Then open the safe. But don't try any tricks.
After more than 2 hours of riding, the three gunmen finally gave up the search for the Lone Ranger and Tonto. Tired and disheartened, they returned their horses to the stable.
Oh, boy.
Boss is going to be mighty sore at us for not finding that masked man.
Yeah. It's getting daylight. You think he'll still be up and waiting for us?
I'm sure he will.
You needn't worry about Regan.
Hey, there he is, the masked man.
You're covered here in the stable.
What are you doing here?
Waiting for you. Otto and the sheriff are with me.
That's right, boys. You're all heading for jail.
Sheriff, I don't savvy.
Take their guns, Otto.
You get them.
The masked man persuaded Regan to open his safe. Do you know what he found there?
Those papers Regan made us sign.
Yeah, telling all about your past crime.
You got those?
Sure did. Here's handcuffs for you.
After leading you men on a wild goose chase, Otto returned with my horse. I sent him to get the sheriff.
I was sure surprised when I saw those papers.
Regan made us sign them.
Yeah, I know about that. He had to have a hold over you so as he'd know that you wouldn't double-cross him.
I knew those papers would make trouble.
And we have evidence to go with him. You crooks are due for a long stay in prison.
Well, Regan's going with us. I can tell plenty about him.
So can I.
Me too.
He's in jail right now on the strength of some stolen jewelry we found in his safe. Things that were stolen from the mayor's home.
When we finish talking, he'll be there for keeps.
Otto, while you help the sheriff take these men to jail, I'll go and tell Jack Barton his troubles are over. I'll watch him burn a slip of paper and send him home to his dad. Adios.
Adios, mister.
How did Jack Barton get that masked man to help him?
I don't know, Lefty, but I reckon that any deserving man has a friend in the Lone Ranger.
This is a feature of The Lone Ranger Incorporated, created by George W. Trendle, produced by Trendle Campbell Muir Incorporated, and directed by Fred Flowerday. Tonight's drama was written by Fran Stryker. The part of The Lone Ranger is played by Brace Beamer.
We wish to thank Fred Flowerday of Special Recordings for the use of the Lone Ranger program, the players, Paul Hughes, Jay Michael, Roland Parker, Elaine Alpert, Ernie Winstanley, and Frank Russell. Our technical advisor was Danny Dallas. Recording engineer, Norm Henry. The program was produced by Bill Booth. This is J.P. McCarthy. Part of our great American heritage has been our Western lore and the romantic and adventuresome names it produced. Names like Wyatt Earp, Billy the Kid, Bat Masterson, Wild Bill Hickok, the Daltons, the Youngers, Jesse James, and Pat Garrett. And most of the time, you couldn't tell the good guys from the bad guys. Not so with the Lone Ranger. He was the good guy. And Brace Beamer was the Lone Ranger. And it is to his memory that this program has been respectfully dedicated.